Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and by Smallville, the complete fifth season available on DVD now. Own the season when the Fortress of Solitude rises and Clark is forced to accept his destiny. Own Smallville, the complete fifth season on DVD now.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
We're here on Film Spotting with Brick writer-director Ryan Johnson. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Of course, we're going to get into a lot of discussion of the movie Brick here, but I actually wanted to start by asking you about yourself a little bit. Where did you grow up? When did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker? And talk a little bit about maybe your experience going to USC.
Sure, yeah. I grew up in Colorado, but I've been in Southern California ever since junior high, and I was just kind of one of those awful, terrible kids that you want to kick in the head who just were running around with a video camera when they were little, as soon as they could hold it up. And I don't know, I've always just grown up making movies with my friends. I did it when I was a little kid, and then when I got into high school and figured out that you could get out of writing book reports by making movies about Hamlet and showing them to your teacher, I did that, and then went to film school, and then got out of film school, and it's kind of been a lifelong thing for me. And so it was, and I don't know, the experience of making Brick was like, it was pretty wonderful in that, just because that is my filmmaking background. Like I didn't get into it doing commercials or doing music videos or TV or anything professional, I guess. It was always just grabbing a group of people and grabbing a camera and going out and making the movie. And that was like kind of the atmosphere on the set of Brick. So to have that be kind of the first experience at making a feature, it was, I don't know, man, it was pretty cool and kind of fitting. And on top of that, to be doing it back in my hometown and at my actual high school, you know, it was a bit of a head trip, I guess, you know.
But for listeners who haven't seen Brick yet and haven't heard us rave about it, maybe some new listeners tuning in, how do you describe it to people, and how did you describe it to people during that long time of trying to get the movie made?
Oh, God. I'm the humiliating thing is I still am really bad at describing it quickly and not having it sound absolutely atrocious. That was the hardest thing, I think, when back in all those kind of 6 years between when I wrote the script and when we finally got to make it, when you would hand the script to someone and you had to give them like a quick little one line, you know, what it is, it's just, you say like it's a film noir in high school, but that conjures up just these awful images of teenagers doing Bogart impressions and like a, you know, kind of like a Bugsy Malone type thing. The thing we finally ended up landing on is Chinatown in high school. That's like the dumb this meets that sort of thing. And even that, I cringe every time I hear it, you know, but sometimes you just need to say it quickly. So now I'm completely relieved that I can just, you know, that the movie is there to kind of speak for itself. Hopefully speak a little more eloquently than I can about it. I don't know.
And we do have this sort of this famous 6 year gestation period. You wrote the script at 23, right out of film school. You didn't start shooting until you're 29. And I guess my question is, and listening to you talk about it on the director's commentary of Brick too, you seem remarkably understanding of why this film took so long to get made. You've admitted, obviously, the script is really a challenging read. And even people who like the script express concern about getting the tone right, the difficulty of that. It could have easily turned out disastrously. Were you ever tempted to write another, more straightforward script and try to get that sold, or doing them simultaneously, or letting somebody else direct your script?
The temptation to have someone else direct it never came up because the script was so weird. It wasn't like people were clamoring for it, like, you know, this would be a gold mine if we put Ridley Scott on this, you know, or something like that. It was the type of thing where I knew that the issue wasn't really my inexperience as a director so much. It was just the fact that it was a very, very bizarre script. In terms of writing something else, yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, there was that hit constantly, and I took a couple stabs at it even, but just nothing that I came up with really. It reached a certain point where I had Brick in my head for so long, and kind of the, and kind of the mass of having to defend it, of people like saying this isn't going to work or how is this going to work, and the fact that that whole time I kind of had this thing in my head and I was like, no, I think this actually will really work. And at a certain point, the longer it took, the more determined I became to just get it up on the screen so that somebody could see exactly how it was going to be executed in a way where certain people would like it, you know. So I don't know, it kind of fed itself, and eventually by the end of it, it was even at the points where it looked like there's not a chance in hell we're going to get this thing done. And even at those points, I knew we were going to get it done eventually, just because I knew, well, we've come this far. I'm not going to stop until we get it made.
And you know, during the course of that 6 years, you actually got a lot of support. You got a lot of people on board.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, that's the real reason that, you stick around long enough and you get the script out to enough people, and eventually it really is like a rock rolling down a hill. It just kind of starts accumulating the right elements. And our casting director was a huge element that about 2 years before we actually made the movie, so about 4 years into the process. Actually, it's when I was one of the editors on my friend Lucky McKee's movie, May, and his casting director, this woman, Shannon McCannion, she was working out of the same house that we were cutting the film in. And so I met her that way, and we handed her the script, and she called me like a week later, like really excited about it. And she kind of just – she's one of those people. She has sunk her teeth into it with this incredible passion and worked for 2 years before we had any money at all. I mean, just bringing in tons and tons of kids for us to see. And, it's finding people like that who – are as passionate about it as you, and it, at some points even more passionate. At some points, they're the ones who are actually pulling the train forward, you know. And that's the other thing that helps. You get a certain amount of people on board who have really invested in it and put their hearts into it. There's no way you can stop. You know, you kind of have to, at that point, you kind of have to just keep running forward. And even if you feel discouraged, you got to just put on your good face and keep running, you know.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Our guest is Ryan Johnson, whose debut film, Brick, is out now on DVD. And you talk a lot about that six-year, seven-year process of getting the film made and, of course, the troubles getting financing and, you know, actors dropping out. What I'm more curious about, though, and for our listeners that want to hear more about that, definitely check out the DVD commentary. What I'm really curious about is maybe how the film changed or evolved in those 7 years. How much of what was on the page initially was in the end product, and how much did your vision change over that time? How did it evolve?
Well, it's interesting. I just recently posted the shooting script and also the original novella that I wrote before the script. I posted them both up online on my website so people can go and download those and check them out. And it's interesting because that means I had to go back in and kind of proofread it and I had to reread it. And it's surprising how little the fundamentals of it, I think, changed from the original conception up to when we actually did it. There was no huge sea change in terms of how the thing was realized. There was some structural stuff. There was a lot of details that were changed for clarity and for length and whatnot. But overall, what's on the page at the beginning, it is pretty clearly translated to what's on the screen at the end of the day. And it's I don't know, it was very weird for me going back and reading that original novella and having the images from the finished film in my head at this point, as opposed to having whatever I had in my head before the movie. It's kind of like making the movie has gelled them in that one specific way. And I don't know, that was kind of odd, I guess.
I know everyone talks about the language in this film, and we certainly will get into that too, because you are imposing this film noir dialogue in this modern day setting. But I am really curious about, as well, the visual touches in the film, I think, are part of what make it so exciting. A lot of the jump cuts, the out of focus dissolve, we get that great kind of transition shot of Brendan's clock and the passage of time. None of those shots seem there just, you know, to be arty. They all make sense and add to the mood. And I'm wondering how many of those were planned from the beginning and how many of them just came out while shooting or in the editing room.
Thank you. I'm really happy to hear you say that. There was a lot of work that we did in the editing room. I mean, probably a bunch of what you're talking about was really meticulously planned out, like the you know, like the garbage bag trash effects, or the garbage bag effects going by, or the instance you said with the out of focus clock, or a lot of the more planned out, like the jump cut shot where Tugger punches Brendan and that it like does that dolly counter zoom in really quick. Those were really carefully planned out, but a lot of kind of the incidental jump cuts in it were not. Those were a product of the editing process. And what had basically happened was, when I was visually planning the film, I was watching a ton of Sergio Leone. And, you know, he's the master of those long, you know, unbroken takes. And so I got this idea in my head that, all right, man, we're going to shoot all these in these long, unbroken single takes. And it's going to be, you know. And then we shot it that way. And then I cut the movie together. And it was way, way too long. And it was way too, you know, the pacing of it just dragged. I think to a large extent because of the nature of the material. I think because the material is taken from Dashiell Hammett, really, well, not taken, but it's very much inspired by Dashiell Hammett, which is, you know, his writing and his language is so staccato and so percussive and so much about economy. And when you take it and stretch it out in this, in that type of visual language, it just didn't pop. And so I went in and just started cutting out the boring parts of all the shots. And that's where those jump cuts ended up coming from. Necessity is the mother of jump cuts, I guess.
Well, yeah, I think this will bring up Hammett as well. I just want to play actually a quick scene from the film. This is Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Brendan and Lucas Haas as the Pin.
How about some Tang? No, that's more like soda, isn't it?
Water's fine, ma'am. Thanks.
Oh, wait a minute. We have apple juice here if you'd like that. Or we've got milk, but you're having that on your cornflakes.
Apple juice sounds terrific.
It's country style.
That's perfect.
And I'll even give it to you in a little country glass. How about that? Boys?
I'm fine, Mrs. M.
Thanks, ma'am.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go do something in the other room.
So, how about we take another snap at hearing your tale?
Oh, no, it starts out same as before. This floor ain't carpeted.
You're cool, though.
The muscle seemed plenty cool putting his fist in my head. Want him out.
And that is, Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Brendan, Lucas Haas as the Pin. They're in the Pin's kitchen. Brendan has sort of infiltrated the lair of the Pin, the quirky bad guy. They're in Pin's kitchen, rather the Pin's mom's kitchen. Brendan is eating cornflakes. The Pin has milk and cookie in front of him, a cape draped dramatically around his shoulders, his cane leaning against the table. And there are moments of wonderful absurdity like this in Brick, and maybe it's hard to tell hearing that scene out of context, but what's so exciting about that scene for me is that, and I think I noticed this particularly seeing it the second time, is that despite the absurdity, the tension that you've worked so hard to establish in the film never breaks. And I wonder if you could talk about why it's so important to have scenes like this and how it helps us to understand the characters.
Well, thank you, first of all. That's a massive compliment for me. That's something that we really worked incredibly hard to try in, and we were very, very conscious of. Or at least I was very conscious of, I should say, I guess. I mean, I think that – I mean, for me, the trick to pulling that off is to just be totally honest. I guess I kind of have to back up a little and talk about kind of the general approach to the making of all this, and kind of when I first sat down with the key people, with Joe and with you know, the key crew members, like kind of the way that we were going to keep this thing from turning into just a really goofy, ridiculous parody or pastiche, I guess. In my mind, the trick was honesty. The trick was, you know, this is a genre that obviously has so much history to it and has so much amazing, incredible stuff in its catalog, and everyone is so familiar with it. For me, it was all about, to the greatest extent that we possibly could. And this is going to, I don't know how this is going to sound, but to a large extent, trying to ignore that while we were making the movie, trying to completely empty our heads of the history of the, or at least my job as a director, I felt, was to get all the creative people to completely empty their heads of the history of the genre, to just be looking down on the page and look at the world that's on the page and say, okay, what are the original creative choices that we're going to make in order to make this material a real tangible world on the screen? Just because I knew everyone would start driving themselves nuts if Nora the whole time was thinking, okay, how am I playing the femme fatale type? So it's contextualized in the previous, you know, versions of it at the same time, making it my own. Or Joe was constantly thinking about the nuances of Bogart's performances. Or, you know, I know everyone would just go crazy, and we would end up with something that was, you know, just a collage as opposed to being a cohesive world. So for me, that was the real trick, was to get everybody just into that headspace of originality, into that headspace of, you know, don't worry about the rules of what you think the genre is supposed to be. Just you know, if it's something that'll work for what's on the page, let's put it in there. Let's throw it in there. Let's do it, you know. And I hope that's why, you know, I hope that's part of the reason why we can have moments like those that do kind of reveal the essential absurdity of the central conceit, and still kind of not blink. You know, there are filmmakers who are masters of that, like the Coen brothers, or I think David Lynch actually is the one who I would really point to and say that guy is, you know, in terms of creating worlds that are on the one hand absolutely alien and largely absurd, and yet you take them incredibly seriously and are frightened and turned on and just completely absorbed in them, you know?
Well, that's a perfect transition, because my next question was going to be about David Lynch. I'm a big Lynch fan, especially of Twin Peaks, and I'm wondering how much of kind of the homages, in a way, I guess, or the nods to Twin Peaks were conscious. You have the murder mystery in high school, even the coffee and pie, oh my. I mean, if you watch, you know, Dale Cooper loves pie, and the yeah. music even, which the music from your cousin, right, Nathan Johnson?
Nathan,
I mean,
yeah.
It's amazing, but it has a little bit of a Badalamenti feel to it. And, of course, the dead girl in the water, even the right. a character like the Pin seems like someone who'd come straight out of Twin Peaks. How much of that was deliberate?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I was in high school, I was Twin Peaks was first airing when I was in high school, and that was kind of that was a pretty massive thing for me. And so a lot of that had seeped into my brain and was also connected up specifically with that period, and to a large extent, I think, affected how I perceived and filtered actual high school, you know, which is pretty messed up, I could probably. But so, yeah, I mean, it's, a lot of that is in there. I mean, like I mentioned before, and actually, incidentally, it's really cool to hear you say that the music reminded you of that, because a lot of, you know, when you're doing your rough cut of your film, the first thing you throw in there is temp music. You just grab your CD collection and put in songs before you have the actual score. And I did a pass at it where it was all you know, Badalamenti, where it was all the music from Fire Walk With Me and a lot from Twin Peaks and from Blue Velvet. And I played it for Nathan. He's like, oh, no, it feels like totally the wrong tone. So it's very gratifying for me to hear that that you heard a lot of that in his music. I'll have to rub that in his face a little bit. Yeah, but again, like I said, though, I mean, I knew all that stuff was going to be in there, just because personally it's stuff that is very much, you know, in my brain. And I knew that there were lots of allusions to the Maltese Falcon, to other, you know, to the Glass Key, to other noirs in there. Again, it was all just for me, that kind of playing the game of knowing that in the back of my head, but making sure that nobody was really conscious of that when we were there, you know, when we were doing the creek scene, that we weren't, you know, that I never even brought up Laura Palmer at all, you know.
Well, you brought up high school, so I want to jump into that a little bit. It's another favorite thing about the film that I really liked. And because you've created these great noir types, obviously, the cynical private eye, the femme fatale, the quirky villain, the heavy. But what I really admire about the characters is that I never forgot that they were high school kids. In fact, honestly, more than any high school movie I can think of, I was reminded of the special kind of agony that is high school, the obsessive emotional investment in relationships and the weird pleasure of detachment and depression. And I wondered how difficult that was to find the balance between noir and the reality of being a teenager, or capturing that.
Well, that's awesome. And I think that, I don't think it was really, this is going to sound weird, it really wasn't much of a challenge at all, because I think they really play into each other so incredibly well. It became a matter of not so much trying to balance them, but just finding that they complemented each other so well. And the more you played one up, the more escalated the other became in a very good way. The more you played up these kind of ridiculous, dangerous stakes of film noir, which, you know, is usually all about kind of a criminal underworld that is this little hermetically sealed world set off apart from the rest of culture that is very stratified and very based on a social structure, and everyone has their place in it, and everyone, you know, and that's to such a large degree exactly what high school is, or at least exactly the way a lot of us remember high school. You know, so much of it is based on that social order, and it feels like you're in this little fishbowl outside of the real world for those 4 years, kind of in your own space. Even down to the patter, you know, the fact that it's a hallmark of not only film noir and movies and books, but of actual criminal culture in America, that, you know, going way back to the beginning of the century, how the criminals had this specific pattern. They had it in order to shield their motives and to shield what they were doing from the outside world. And that's exactly what high schoolers have. Again, going all the way back to Rebel Without a Cause, or to, you know, back to a West Side Story. I mean, that's also a hallmark of being a teenager. I mean, the correlations between the two worlds are uncanny. And in terms of getting to the kind of the emotional state of being in high school, I mean, that was something that Joe and I talked about quite a bit, and that I'm always really incredibly happy when people actually feel that from the film, that, you know, Brick obviously doesn't try and portray high school realistically at all. It's obviously not a realistic depiction of high school. At the same time, emotionally, I think maybe it is a little closer to the subjective experience of how high school felt like, you know, and that's, I don't know, that's beautiful for me to see that kind of translate on the back end of things.
I just wanted to ask one question about the language, and because I think the language absolutely works, that heightened stylized language, but I was watching the one scene in particular between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Nora Sahetner, Brendan and Laura. Brendan's just given the beat down to Brad, this brash jock. Laura follows Brendan and offers him help, and it's a really nice emotionally charged scene. Brendan is speaking really, really plainly to her, which is, of course, part of his agenda, but he says, "I don't trust you," and it's a wonderful scene, but I found myself, and this really alone, in this scene particularly, I found myself almost wanting them to speak more plainly. Was there ever a time when you felt like the language got in the way of the emotional reality, or was there ever a time during the course of maybe the 6 years where you thought about dropping the heightened stylized language?
I never considered dropping it. I did consider toning it back, and this is going to sound weird, but we did actually tone it back to a large degree, and even in the editing process was where that largely came to the surface. Where, and on the DVD, there's a thing of deleted scenes, and there's a few where it's the same scene, except there's a couple extra lines in it, and it did just at the end of the day was. You know, this was obviously as my first feature. It was a real learning process for me, and part of that, part of what I felt I really learned from it was just the power of economy and the power of, you know, of saying as much as possible with as few lines as possible. So yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I'm sure there are definitely instances in it where less would have been more. At the same time, you pick your horse and you kind of make a commitment to the style of the thing, and you just kind of ride with it, you know.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. We're talking to Brick writer-director Ryan Johnson. And Ryan, we just have a couple more questions for you here. We're talking about the dialogue, and it really is great. And I wasn't surprised at all to hear, of course, some of the actors on the commentary talk about how much fun it was to say, because it's that much fun to listen to. But I think what's really interesting for me is how the movie really sets up a system where the audience kind of is forced to realize how every piece of information is important. There's this urgency in the way Brendan approaches everything, where he knows that the time he has with some of these people, especially when he gets a chance, to talk to Emily DeRaven's character, that time is short and she's going to leave soon, and these characters have to piece everything together later. So it's really about listening as much as it is saying this great dialogue. And I'm wondering how much of that was by design.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I don't know. It's an interesting thing for me to talk to people who have watched the movie, especially for the first time, and to hear kind of their experience in parsing it, I guess. And that was something that I was, obviously I'd had this material in my head for so long that was something that I was a little frightened about that I didn't feel like I had a really good handle on in terms of – and that was something, again, which led to what I talked about before during the editing process of thinning some things out, or we even did go back in and change some lines. There's a lot of lines in the movie which are – if you look really, really closely, the lips don't exactly match the lines because we overdubbed them with something a little simpler actually. So for me, it's fascinating to hear – people talk about the point at the end. It seems generally that there's a point in the movie, maybe like, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes in, where people either fall on one side of the fence or the other with it. You know, people either decide that they're into it and they're going to go with it and they're going to, you know, kind of that everything is kind of clicking for them, or there's a disconnect that happens and the language is, you know, is just alienating and it's too much and they kind of push away and decide it's not their kind of thing. And I don't know, for me, it's as enjoyable to hear both perspectives for me, just because it's fascinating for me just to hear how the movie is bouncing off of people, I guess, how people are listening to it.
Yeah, no, and I love that you don't, you know, give people a chance to maybe jump back on board if they've already given up. I think that makes
It was a really conscious decision that the movie hits the ground running and it doesn't look back over its shoulder to make sure that you're catching up. And that's something that is, you know, is makes it a movie that's not for everybody. But that's why we made it small, and that's why it's, you know, and what a lot of my favorite movies are movies that are not for everybody. You know, that's I like that.
The performance of Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I know he had a huge role in you know, really pushing the film along creatively. Really, I think he's given two of the best performances, you know, I've seen in the past year in Mysterious Skin and in Brick, and they're two completely antithetical performances. And I think he's really good, and I'm wondering, you know, did you see something in him that really piqued your interest about how successful he could be in this role here, or, you know, how did he get involved?
Yeah, that was just a casting session thing. It was just he read the script and then they set it up and we sat down and had lunch, and just that first meeting between us, I really didn't know much of his work because they just finished shooting Mysterious Skin, so I hadn't seen that. I had seen him in a movie called Manic that he did with Don Cheadle.
Yeah, that's good.
And I wasn't familiar actually with his – I had never seen like 10 Things I Hate About You or Angels in the Outfield, or I hadn't even really seen his TV show. So maybe I had, you know, the benefit of not having any sort of bias towards him in that regard. I just knew him from this one movie, and I sat down and talked to him, and he was this – just so incredibly bright and just so completely got kind of the central thing of Brick and what it would take to put it up on the screen. And I could also immediately tell that he was going to throw himself into it completely, which he did. He became much more of a filmmaking partner than anything else on it, which, you know, for a first-time director is a hell of a blessing.
The last thing I was wondering about is, and I know this is probably more budget-related, but also being a filmmaker, a guy who's writing and directing, you also edited Brick, and you started as an editor. Do you always see yourself editing your own films, or as the budgets grow, do you expect to bring someone in? And
I don't know. That's a good question, and that's something that I've been giving a lot of thought to with the next movie, actually, and I don't know yet. I mean, I can't say that it was entirely a budget thing on Brick. I love editing. I love that part of the process. For me, that's really the completion of the writing process, you know, is editing. And there's nothing I love more than sitting down and working with footage. And I'm just afraid that I would, you know, get really antsy sitting there letting someone else have the fun, you know.
Which sounds awful.
At the same time, I've been giving a lot of thought to the idea that having another collaborative voice in the process at that point of it could be invaluable and could be something really beautiful to experience. So I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about it right now.
Well, we have one final question here for you, and I don't know how many times you've been asked it, but I'm sure if your fans got your attention, it's what they'd want to know, and it's what's next.
Oh, yeah. I've written a con man movie. It's a con man movie called The Brothers Bloom, and it's kind of a globe-trotting con man adventure. I'm so excited about it. It's I don't know what I don't want to say too much about it, I guess, but it's really going to be fun. And it's similar to Brick in that it's kind of – it's very much its own world, but it's also a much broader movie than Brick, and it's not quite as quite as sealed up in its own reality. It's a little more open, I think. But the con man genre is one of my favorite film genres, and I'm terrified and excited to try and take a crack at it. Knock on wood.
How close are you to shooting that?
I think we're gonna knock on wood one more time. We're gonna shoot the beginning of next year if everything goes smoothly. And why shouldn't it?
There you go. Well, we're definitely looking forward to that. And again, we really appreciate your time. We have 20 more questions at least we'd love to ask you. But hopefully we can have you on the show another time, maybe when The Brothers Bloom comes out.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you so much for your support of the movie on the show and for your show in general, force for good in the universe.
Thank you. Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Smallville, the complete fifth season on DVD now. Own the incredible season when Clark faces rogue Kryptonians, Lex launches a vicious political campaign, and the Fortress of Solitude rises. Aquaman surfaces and other key elements of Superman lore fall into place. Smallville, the complete fifth season includes all 22 episodes, unaired scenes, commentaries, and the exclusive behind-the-scenes look at the making of the 100th episode. Own Smallville, the complete fifth season on DVD now.